Good evening, this is Gary Kavner here on the right side of my friend and colleague Michael Dwyer. I'm back in the driving seat today after some unfortunate technological issues meant I had to leave the ship to Michael. Today's stories. A Fine Gael candidate in one of the by-elections has come under basically a drumbeat of controversy. She says something, she apologises. It comes out she said another thing, she apologises. She visits a direct provision centre, she then says something, she apologises, and it just doesn't seem to stop. And then we want to talk about some comments that Leo made. He was announcing that there will be a new Citizens' Assembly on gender equality, although having looked at what the Citizens' Assembly will actually be looking at, it is in fact a Citizens' Assembly on women's rights, more than one on gender equality. He said that no one would ever make the mistake of saying that men and women in Ireland are equal. So we want to talk a little bit about that. So, Michael, should we start with the first of those stories, My Verona?
Yeah, I think Verona has basically... I don't want to take this overly personally.
Because you were flying the flag for this one.
Well, I would say flying the flag.
I would.
Yeah, well, of course you... As I said, you would, wouldn't you? I'm there. She comes out with a couple of statements. They're jumping all over her head. Now, God knows, it's far from me to be the cheerleader or the man on the ditch shouting on the Fine Gael candidate in County Wexford in the by-election. But it seemed to me that the reaction was wildly over the top in what she had said, while maybe, shall we say, infelicitously phrased, as sometimes is the case with people who are not professional politicians yet, or indeed in the case of many of our politicians. I thought, you know, the basic point, first of all, she was making the point that there were people that were coming from war zones and maybe were carrying angst with them and had maybe had suffered traumatic incidents, and they needed support and help of the kind that they wouldn't maybe necessarily get in places like Uachtarard or in places like Achill or Moyne. And I think that's perfectly valid. The point I made in the podcast was, if you look at the kind of things, if for example, I don't know if we have, but amongst some of the Syrian refugees coming into the country, if some of those were Yazidi women, for example, who had been in the ISIS territory, what these women might have experienced or observed or participated in, absolutely horrific, and they will need all sorts of serious psychotherapeutic and medical supports of the kind which you're unlikely to find in Achill Island and far more likely to find in a large urban centre. Then she talked about the fact that there was ISIS and connection. I said, well, you know, fact is we know that when people lose wars, the bad guys very often dress up as the victims and try and pass themselves off. We know that there were people, if you remember the great Million Man March that was trekking across the Middle East and then through Greece and the Balkans, knocking on the door of Germany. Well, we know that people went in and looked, and they found that there were people there who were at the very least suspicious. And there were individuals that were pointed out by victims, genuine victims of the war in Syria, pointed out because they saw them in camps, in reception areas. They said, that guy over there, he's one of them. He was one of those guys. I saw him do X, Y, and Z. So it wasn't an unreasonable thing to say whether or not... So I'm saying all of this. I'm trying to think, you know, Verona, you know, God bless her, what are they at? I had hardly finished speaking, Gary.
I think the podcast was up an hour before the next comments came out, which I deeply enjoyed the timing of.
Barely, if we could speak figuratively, was the ink dry. She comes out again. And then after that, again. And then and I think, now Verona, we're slightly taking the Michael here.
I mean, and then Charlie Flanagan has her brought to a direct provision centre so she can speak about the personal growth she's undertaken.
You know, you can't...
And how she recognises those were terrible things to say and she will never say them again. And then I think that one got about 3 hours.
But don't you just love the image that sentence conjures up? Charlie Flanagan brought her to a reception centre. We can almost imagine the re-education classrooms are there ready for Verona and her pals, that they will be re-educated in the reception centre. And Charlie, of course, a very liberal man, very committed to the liberal progressive program of the government. So, well, I suppose let's start. What in the chronology of it? After I've said my little piece, she comes on, and what was the next thing? Was that the 3 year olds?
I think that was the 3 year olds. Yeah, the 3 year olds and ISIS.
How does that work, Gary? How do you? I mean, you've done a bit of psychology in the past, haven't you? Can you plant? Can you turn a 3 year old into a little ticking secret time bomb?
I must say that child development was the part of psychology that hurt me the most, Michael, because I have no interest in it. And you cannot imagine how tedious it is to read endless studies about children throwing balls at mirrors.
So Piaget doesn't have anything about creating ISIS children?
I mean, there's a little bit about creating trauma.
Right.
Making people afraid of anything white and fluffy.
Let's be nicer. What do you think she meant?
I actually have no idea. I mean, when I saw her original remarks and she said, "I am under no illusion that ISIS is a big part of the migrant community." And my initial thought was, does that mean she is under no illusion and they are a big part? Or is she saying, "I don't believe they are a big part"?
Yeah, that wasn't awfully clear to me. Again,
accuracy. The problem then is once it becomes a problem, she'll talk to the party PR guys and they will say, "Doesn't matter what you meant, and under no bloody circumstance are you to respond to a charge of racism by going, 'Well, that's not what I meant.'"
Maybe overly charitably, I'd assumed that she meant that, you know, she wasn't under any illusions that it was a big part. Simply because, well, we've discussed this before, if you go down through the top 10 countries applying for asylum into the country and migrate coming into the country, countries like Georgia, Albania, and Nigeria don't tend to have a big ISIS profile. You wouldn't have said Albania was a hotbed. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's information available to Verona that isn't available to me, that there's a big problem with ISIS.
Now she has the problem that she's starting to get headlines like, "Fine Gael TD says comments by party by-election candidate dangerous." Now, Michael, would you like to guess which TD it is?
Oh, we're playing guessing in.
Because you got a Fine Gael TD going into a national newspaper to attack a by-election candidate. In an election where there's only four candidates, and Fine Gael really need to win, even just for morale, at least one of them.
And Wexford is the one that they think they can win.
So, on that basis, what Fine Gael TD do you think would do something like that?
Oh, God. Okay, can I ask gender here? Can I get...
Male.
Noel Rock.
Absolutely. I also, when I saw that headline, went, "I would bet you that's Noel Rock." And then you scroll down a little bit and what you have is Noel Rock, who is chair of the Committee on Housing, criticised her comments on Monday. It was nice of them to say he's the chair of the Committee on Housing, even though it's totally irrelevant to the subject at hand.
Actually, it is tangentially connected to this story. I was, you know, when you hear, when you see in a newspaper is obviously frame a headline in a certain way to tilt a story to advise you, give you a sense of what way they're going, the story is going to go. When we listen to the news on the radio, I think, well, people like me who are very old, therefore, they're like listening to the radio, which was either BBC or RTE, therefore state broadcasters, and with the assumption that this was they were married to the idea of some kind of impartiality and truth in the news and all that kind of thing. So you tend to, I suppose, instinctively, I assume, or I expect that kind of phrasing, that kind of language approach from all radio stations. I was listening to, I think it was, what is it? It's News Talk. And the story about the ISIS friend, Mrs. Smith.
Ah, yes, Miss Smith.
Who was, the report was on whether or not, you know, she was going to be coming home and whether, Is she one? You know, Turkey are deporting a certain number of people.
Hmm.
And this is basically great news because it takes the decision out of the hands, in a sense, at that level of whether or not to repatriate or not, out of the hands of the government, because the Turks just if the Turks repatriate them, there's nothing we can do about it. The lead-in story, if you were going to write a headline, Gary, and you wanted to identify Lisa Smith to the listener, and you wanted to give her an adjective or a qualifier that would make people understand, oh yeah, that's who Lisa Smith is, what kind of word would you attach to her? What qualifiers or describers would you think are the ones most likely to remind people who Lisa Smith was?
Terrorist, treasonous.
Okay, terrorist, treasonous, good.
A lot of T's terrorist, there.
Treasonous, terrorist, T-R. I would possibly, ISIS fighter, ISIS volunteer.
Well, I mean, if we can just say the name of the group, that's really cheating. It ruins the point of the game.
That's not what...
Islamist,
yeah. Good one, yeah. That wasn't the road they chose to go on when reporting the story. The qualifier they decided to go with, because that's the bit that really would have been confusing people, you know, that needed clarity on this, was...
Well, it wasn't beautiful, was it?
No, it was Irish woman. Irish woman, Lisa Smith, comma, and then the story continued. Because that was the bit everybody was confused about and everybody wasn't sure about. That's the word that you'd need to remind people of, isn't it? Irish woman. It just amused me, and it's a small thing, but it's a little window into the headline writing for News Talk. That their story is, yes, she may be lots of things, but what is she? At the end of the day, lads, she's Irish.
Yeah, I think we've had a conversation before about whether or not it should be possible to strip citizenship from people.
And you're far more favourable. I mean, I'm much more sceptical about that than you are. But this just amused me, this notion that the if you're choosing to qualify or a qualifier descriptor to attach to her, the one you'd come up with was Irish woman.
I just love the fact that someone can go to another part of the world, join an entity dedicated to the destruction of the country that you originally came from, as that country is part of a larger Christian project. And then afterwards people will go, but sure, she's Irish and needs help. And you sort of go, well,
yeah.
I think after the whole positive destruction of Ireland, I think we can sort of go, our obligations here are limited.
Yeah, and then there may be a good, you may have a point there that the obligations that we have as a people or a nation or a state can't be described as absolutely limitless. Anyway, returning to the problems of Verona, I am obviously unsurprised that Noel should have been the one to throw the headline in the opinion section in the Indo was Murphy's candidacy for Fine Gael becoming a growing headache for Taoiseach. And you know, Leo hates a headache.
Well, as we saw with Maria Bailey, you can get away with rather a spectacular amount before he'll actually pull the trigger.
Yeah, but the thing is here, is there a trigger?
Well, you see, you're forgetting an important thing about Verona.
Yeah?
Verona is the president of the Hauliers Association.
She is, correct.
Who is someone that politicians would generally not want angry at them.
Yeah, you don't want to. You don't want for 300 or 400 Arctics.
There is nothing like a Hauliers strike to just fuck your election right up.
Yeah, the Hauliers, they are the last of, I suppose, ESB strike would be there. Once upon a time, it would have been the coal miners, because if you didn't have enough coal to run anything. But nowadays, yeah, Haulier, when you start running out of fresh milk and there's no fresh bread and the kiwis are last week's, then the people start to get antsy. Now, I read in the Gory Guardian, I think it was people newspapers anyway, that she's saying that, of course, there has to be empathy for people coming out of these things, but that we have to take into account the possibility that these children, as young as 3 or 4, have already been manipulated. And by that, I presume she's not talking about some kind of spinal adjustment. But the thing is, yeah, Leo and triggers and pulling, but there's nothing they can do. They're not going to say, well, we're going to throw in another candidate at this stage. I don't understand why they are doing this. Why they just didn't double down. Why they didn't come out in a frenzy and say, you've misunderstood me. Sat her down in a darkened room and told her, shut the fuck up, you. From now on, you say nothing that isn't
you,
scripted.
You don't talk anymore.
You
after those trucks you oversee and just move from place to place, being seen.
I overheard, I won't say, who, but in one campaign I was a little involved in, I overheard a Labour candidate being spoken to by their campaign manager or director of elections or whatever it was, and it was one of the most remarkable pieces of tearing off I've ever heard. The language was absolutely terrific in its colour, but they were told in no uncertain terms, you don't get to talk. And the person said, but I have ideas. No, you don't. You don't get to have ideas. You don't get to talk. You get to read. And one of the greatest regrets of my life was I wasn't able to work out how to get the record function on my laptop to work in time to record the thing. Because even just for posterity, it would have been a wonderful thing. And I suspect, I don't understand why they just didn't do a little bit of that. Because all the stories are now is Charlie Flanagan is upset with her. Leo is upset with her. The party is upset with her. You know, why would you make that the story when you're, what, a fortnight out from voting? Not even a fortnight out from voting. That's the story. Get behind the lady. Also, let's ask, honestly, seriously, how much of this is losing her votes with the people of Wexford?
I would say not a lot.
How many of the people who find what she said really offensive and would affect their way of voting would ever have considered voting for Verona in the first place?
It might hurt her slightly on transfers. I think she has actually less of a problem than Lorraine Clifford Lee, as Lorraine Clifford Lee actually said things that would annoy on a personal level the people in the constituency she's running in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, no one cares about things she said that may appear to be racist. They're just, like, that's terrible of you, but we're not going to change our vote.
But she has made comments that are fairly obviously about other people and other young women in her constituency.
I would love to know what Lorraine Clifford Lee did to piss off the Independent. Because if you notice the Independent very clearly has a great deal of things that Clifford Lee said. And there are a number of things I know she said that they haven't come out with yet. And they seem to be in this slow drip feed, deliberate maximisation of damage to Clifford Lee.
So you think this is a yes?
I don't know if she's annoyed someone.
No, but I mean, you say that the stuff that they haven't come out with yet. You think there will be more to come?
Oh, absolutely. There are a number of other things she said in her Twitter, which I believe have subsequently been deleted. I think she just scrubbed the entire thing at this point.
Yeah.
That are definitely going to get brought out at some point. She's a real bee in her bonnet about religion. There are a couple of comments about women needing to keep their legs closed. Like, the Indo seems to just be trying to hurt her. And probably doing so successfully.
Is it not possible that the honest and robust sense of humour of the ordinary Northsider in the street will find all of this a little bit over the top? And what harm? And sure, isn't it what you'd say to your, if you're saying to somebody sitting on the bus on a Saturday night anyway?
Yeah, apart from the one I actually think will actually harm her the most is her comments about the right venue.
Yeah, that, and probably not so much with the people going to the right venue as maybe the mothers and fathers of the people.
Yeah, I can absolutely see someone seeing Lorraine Clifford Lee says the right venue is the slut venue and immediately going, but my daughter goes there, or my son went there, and he met his girlfriend there.
So, I don't know, did you see, I have to say Verona is not helping herself. Because not only she says the stuff about the asylum seekers and the migrants, but then why would she go after Owen Murphy? And in a rather incoherent way, she's reported as being against the mixing of housing developments with apartment blocks. But then at the same time, I said, that Mr. Murphy's attitude is let them have cake.
Which is weird because she also says, she made a point that addiction and bad choices lead people to become homeless, which is perfectly true.
It's not helpful to say it though.
No, but particularly immediately after his attitude is let them eat cake. And also, by the way, they're there because they're addicts and they made poor choices.
And you've got 10,000 people homeless.
See, then it kind of sounds like you're saying that the problem is not that he is saying let them eat cake in an arrogant way, yeah, but that he's offering to provide food.
Also, yes, he says have cake, not eat cake. Let them have cake. That was odd. That was an odd choice.
Trade it in some sort of barter system for heroin.
And then when you have the number of people that we have on who are homeless, to go into what is fairly obviously victim blaming. And then just the tin hat. I'm not exactly sure when this came out in the chronology of the whole thing. But she has then a pop at the drink driving laws. That they are not proportionate policing. Now, I have, she's from Ramsgrange, so we won the more, the most, I suppose, rural parts of the county down the south, heading for the Hook. And if you're around there, a lot of people would be not maybe comfortable walking distance, but to the pub and possibly, is it hard to get a taxi in Ramsgrange? But she's making the kind of point that you expect from a Healy Ray or from somebody should say in on the Atlantic coast. It's not something you expect from somebody in Wexford, where, you know, there are lots of rural, nice rural parts of Wexford, but it's not really that kind of place where it's. I wouldn't have thought that it was a big, big issue. Why would you, as president of the Irish Road Haulage Association as well, by the way, you know, I would have thought that being a stickler for the sobriety of drivers would have been one of your things.
Or at least the appearance of being a stickler.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, yes. To move on, Leo. So this comment is actually, these are comments Leo made during the summer.
Yeah.
When he was announcing the establishment of the assembly. But it's back in the news. Because the journal needed something to talk about on International Men's Day and apparently notifying people that the Citizens' Assembly on Gender Equality would be starting soon was that thing.
That's the takeout from International Men's Day. Not that men, that the gap between, the longevity gap between men and women is getting bigger or that more men are dying of diseases less money is spent increasing. That women's diseases consistently are the gap between the attention and the money in research of these diseases getting bigger?
No, this was the only thing that went up. And it went up at sometime around 8 or half 8. So there may have been a little bit of, oh bollocks, we forgot about that.
Do you know what we forgot actually?
What do we have on gender? Throw it up.
What we forgot last week, I think, was it Sunday?
The Alamo?
No. Although we forget the Alamo too. So we don't remember the Alamo.
To our shame.
To our shame. We should remember it far more often. No, we missed International Tolerance Day.
I'd prefer to think that we tolerated it.
Well, I think that we should have celebrated. I think there should have been cake and balloons. But anyway, if we're still alive next year, we'll do it.
We could have we could have face painting.
Oh, face painting!
Like the doll had over the weekend.
I'd be a cat. No, I'll be a wolf or a panda. Maybe a panda.
So anyway, it's back in the news, so we may as well talk about it because I think we missed it at the time. So Leo, when he was announcing it, said that no one could argue for a single second, that Ireland is a country in which men and women are equal. We fall very short of that, and the current pace of change and the current rate of progress is too slow. It could take many generations before women and men in Ireland are truly equal. And this is one of those great, wonderful, wonderful truisms of the modern age. I've heard so many people say this, that, you know, in no way are we a country in which men and women are equal. Very few of them have been able to explain how we're not equal. Generally, you get a sort of moment of confusion that someone would actually ask a follow-on question. And then someone goes, but the wage gap.
Okay. The wage gap, right? Because we have another day that we didn't celebrate sufficiently anyway. Was it last week, week before, was the day for when they announced that for the rest of the year, women would be working for free.
Which is a ridiculous point, because by this time in the year, we're all working for free because we all pay tax.
Indeed. They were talking about, this was in the context, which the government still talks about, the civil government-related bodies produce, the European Union talks about, and they talk about it in the context of equality and discrimination, this wage gap. How long would you say is it, how, since a wage economist has taken seriously the notion in the Western world that there is this massive wage gap between men and women?
They don't, because they know it's not true. It is, by any definition, a zombie idea. Anyone who researched it knows it is incorrect, but NGOs, activists, and the civil service...
Absolutely, but my point is that it's not just that it's a zombie idea, but it's been known to be a zombie idea for years. I mean, it's decades ago since this was when they actually went back in the... Back in the 70s in the United States, this was already an exploded idea.
Shall we give just a quick explanation of why it's incorrect?
Fire.
Okay, so the gender pay gap, for those who don't know, basically does is a ratio which looks at what men earn versus what women earn. The way it is generally presented to people is they will say, well, men earn a dollar, women earn 78 cents, and therefore women are paid less than men, which is to say that a man and a woman in the same job are paid less. Or sorry, the woman is paid less in the same job. But that's not what it actually measures. What it actually measures is it takes every man and every woman in a country, at least according to the legal economy that they can measure, and basically compares them and then says, well, that this is proof of discrimination, despite the fact that it is measuring men and women just as groups which have very different work preferences. There is absolutely no way to show that any difference is due to discrimination. And in fact, Uber did a very good study on this somewhat sort of accidentally, because the Uber app, you can't tell the sex of your passengers and you can't tell the sex of your driver. But they found that men and women still earn different amounts when you average them out as groups, because their work patterns are different.
Yeah.
So in general, the problem with the idea of the wage gap is that it's actually less to do with what it is, and more to do with how people try and sell it. Like this thing here, where people go, oh, from now on, women are working for free, as if any individual woman has lost out due to discrimination. When in fact, they're just saying, if you look at the life choices of men and women and the jobs that they prefer, on average, men will go for jobs that pay higher wages over other things like work-life balance, personal enjoyment of the job, and pretty much anything that would avoid causing you to become a soulless husk.
So, if you wanted to just to a couple of, say, concrete examples from either end of the food chain, if you want. First of all, if we look at the highest average paying degree for starting wages for graduates, the degree that will get you the biggest money quickest is a degree in petrochemical engineering, right? And that's... Oh, then other things like any other kind of engineering, aeronautical engineering, whatever. Engineering is just about the last department in the university where you have a significant majority of male graduates over female graduates. Now, obviously, we're always talking within a curve here. You know, women and men are far more similar to each other than they are dissimilar. Women within the group, women are more dissimilar to each other than they are to men, and men the same. So we're talking on a better curve here, and the curve only really becomes highly differentiated at either tail. On the other hand, if you look at jobs, so obviously there we're talking about people doing degrees which are academically very challenging and very difficult and requiring a lot of skills of a certain kind. If you look on the other hand, if you're a 20-year-old and you don't really have any educational qualifications, you're not academically gifted, you don't have other special skills, the fact is that there still are high-paying jobs available to men, to young men that are not available. Well, that's not they're not available, but they're not the choices made by young men. For example, you can go on a boat and fish for a snow crab off in the Bering Sea off Alaska, and you will make a lot of money. Or you can go and you can work as a lumberjack, or that's not the phrase that people actually work in the bin called, they call it something else, but a person that chops down trees in Canada or in the United States. Now, those two jobs are also, by the way, the two most dangerous jobs in the world, with incredibly high rates of fatality and or serious accident. Another very dangerous job, you'll be surprised to know, for example, is underwater welder. Now, that's one that requires not just physical strength and youth and courage, but also actually a high degree of skill. Underwater welders are very highly paid and tend to be mostly male. If you're looking at the low-wage, low-qualification jobs that are available to women, there are far fewer because they tend to go into, say, things like early childhood education or home care. And these are not jobs where people tend to die, and they tend to be much lower paid. But then in the middle of all of this, you have the choices that people make regarding how they develop their careers. Now, you've looked at this, Gary, haven't you? Like, if you're talking about, for example, hours worked, weekends worked, willingness to travel, etc.
I mean, yeah, I have. I've looked at it both as a general across various countries. And I also looked fairly in-depth at academics, which I was particularly interested in because there's not a lot of physical differences there that would be impactful other than intelligence. And frankly, a lot of academia is more rote memorization and saying the right thing than anything else. You can show this incredibly easily. And it's a very simple thing. You poll men and women on what they want in life and what their aspirations are. One of the top on any poll you do of men will be high wage.
Yeah.
One of the top when you do it on women will be work-life balance. Wage will be there, but it generally won't make the top three, oftentimes not the top five. They prioritize different things. And from that, I mean, if you want different things in life, I don't think it's any way surprising that two people who want different things will go about different ways of living, each designed to maximize what they want. And the interesting thing I always found about the gender wage gap area is that, and it's kind of a thing I have with the current wave of feminism, in many ways, it sees the only meaningful criteria of success as being those criteria that were traditionally seen as masculine, their social prestige, their money.
Yeah, whereas, it's not just masculine, ironically, isn't it? It's masculine and capitalist.
And in many cases, actively hostile to things that would have been considered traditionally feminine. So,
yeah, but I think that's where a feminist, that, and this is the love here, a feminist, what most feminists, academic feminists anyway, and I think this is where Leo's coming from, will want to completely unpack the idea that there is such a thing as the feminine.
Yeah, the problem is they're going to, the problem they have had, and the probably a lot of people have had, probably most notably the Soviets, is that eventually you just run headfirst into the wall of biological reality.
Yeah, you see, but that's why you say that they run to the wall. Actually, that's why this is a perfect problem. The core feminist belief is that all human activity, all human culture is constructed, that we live in a patriarchy.
I mean, I've legitimately had conversations with a college-educated woman, a highly educated woman, who said that the only reason that men and women are different heights is because parents subconsciously lessen the amount of food they give their daughter.
Absolutely. I have been in conversations where people have genuinely asked the question and then discussed why rockets are shaped like phalluses and not like breasts.
Because those things are aerodynamic. There was also the famous description of Newton's Principia Mathematica,
yes,
as a manual for rape, which I think was my favourite.
What will happen, what they will say is that, say for example, the choices. If you poll men and women, women will place a higher importance or higher degree of importance on spending time with their family and spending time with their children than men will in relation to the importance of their career or their salary. Now, that will mean that, for example, if women place a higher value on that, and this is the issue of work-life balance, they are more likely to spend more time at home and less likely to spend time in the office, more likely not to want to travel, more likely not to want to work at weekends or late. So, and that means that they will end up earning less. This is the point, I think, the point you're making, and it's very important, that there are two weird things going on there. They are implicitly saying that the male choice is the better choice. The choice not to spend time with your family, not to spend time with children, that those are lesser roles, less important, and that spending time in your work and making more money is actually the more important role. But what they will say is that these are choices that are culturally structured, and what we have to do is unpack those. Now, you will answer, you because you're a biologist. You say it's biology, that there is an essential essentialist component to this, that you reach a certain point where you just stop.
I think just actually one quick thing on that point on height.
Yeah.
If the listener is someone who actually does think that. If you look at average heights during regions which are seeing extreme periods of famine and have seen them across many years, the same pattern is there. There's no place in the world I can think of where women are on average taller than men, regardless of the environmental factors that have gone into it at any point. But there was one thing you said there where they were saying about unpacking this and, you know, tearing things down.
Yeah.
But why? I mean, if they say, let's say, well, women only value friendship more because they're cultured to like friendship more. Most of the survey results I've seen suggest that women are happier than men and think they lead better lives. So, okay, they've been encultured into something and it's led to them being happier and thinking they lead better lives. Is that really something we need to start tearing down? Is that really a negative belief? And it just seems like they want to tear it down and replace it with their own beliefs, which are...
The best known example of unpacking this as an idea is when we compare outcomes between developed and less developed countries. So if you were to look at the gender balance in different areas, would you expect... For example, if you're looking at engineering, will you see if we regard 50-50 as the paradigm, the optimum outcome, which does better? Is it India or Sweden?
It's going to be India. I think Iran was the world leader.
Yes, and India does very well. Sweden, where through cultural changes, legal changes, societal changes, it has produced a society which is amongst the most gender equalized in the world.
Pisses them off to no end.
Yeah. Also produces results which are amongst the most gendered when you come to certain occupations.
I really like that is described as the equality paradox, or the gender equality paradox. Mm. And I've always loved it, because to describe it as a paradox is to say you have a very specific view of human nature.
Yeah.
If you take a more biological view of things, the idea that as material comforts go up and societal controls go down, people revert more to their base inclinations is in no way paradoxical or even in any way counterintuitive.
And that's, for the listener, that's the point of the Swedish example, is that what it shows is that in countries like India, where you have your choices are far more restricted, people will not choose necessarily those things that interest them, but those things that are economically and advantageous or materially advantageous to them. They take the opportunities that they can get. If you're a country like Sweden, where increasingly they're going towards a point where basically people can do what they want, where there won't be a negative perceived social comment. For example, on a man assuming a role which historically would have been considered to be feminine, say, a man being a housekeeper or a man being a nurse or a man being a nanny, whatever. In Sweden, you're looking at very, very low levels of negative social backfeed on that. So the assumption would be that since you deconstructed the negative stereotypes associated with these behaviours, men will flock into them. But they don't. You've got in nursing in Sweden is 90% female, 10% male, or something like that. And so it goes through the professions. It is very, very gendered because people are in a position of well-being where they get to choose to do the things that they actually want to do or they're actually interested in doing.
I mean, we do seem to have this thing in Ireland that well, people will say, well, 50% of politicians aren't women, or 50% of CEOs aren't women, or 50% of anything aren't women. And we just take it as an axiomatic truth that the only reason that could happen is due to discrimination. There's never any proof of discrimination, just an assumption that it must be discrimination, because what rational being wouldn't want to become a TD?
Now, I think it's important, just to say at least in passing, that one of the problems here, I think, is that this is a symptom of a problem which is wider. And that's the belief that we need to do something now to deal with problems that existed in the past. There is no doubt that until not that long ago, there were actual, real, systemic, legal impediments, as well as cultural and social ones, but actual legal impediments to women pursuing the kinds of careers, the kinds of life choices that they would have wanted to. My mother was a nurse. When she got married in the 1960s, she had to stop nursing in a public hospital.
I mean, that's absolutely true. But the point I would make there is, after those bans were lifted, certain sectors saw women flood into them in massive numbers and no longer have any gender disparity. And many of them, women are the dominant force. They're the highest amount of graduates. They are the dominant sex statistically in that field.
Yes.
And then in others, we didn't see that. And the fields we didn't see that in are largely the fields we wouldn't have expected to see it in. I mean, in STEM, for all people say there is a STEM disparity, if you go into something like psychology, or you go into something like biology, there is not a lack of women in those courses.
If you look at medicine, medicine is increasingly a feminized profession.
I mean, that is a good example, but even there, men and women tend to go into different specialities.
Absolutely. If you look, I was talking recently to a friend of mine who teaches postgrad courses, and he was in medicine, and he was saying, if you look, for example, at the courses, if there's a 5-year specialization now in general practice, the vast majority of his students are women. But if you go into certain kinds of surgery, there is still a very strong male presence. Now, which we could explain for different reasons. But we know that in science, the more you are dealing with something which is alive, the more likely it is you're going to have a strong female presence. The more you're dealing with things which are inanimate objects, the more likely you are to have a strong male presence. Because that seems to be the dominant interest trait.
Yeah, it's referred to generally as the personalization versus systemization split. Men tend, there's some quite interesting research in fairly newborn infants, where male and female children will go towards different toys. Women will tend towards toys that are more personalized, things like dolls, things that have faces.
Yes.
Boys tend to more towards structural things, objects, vehicles, things that can be built. And you can find that in children so young that there can be no conceivable way it's been enculturated into them.
In fact, you not only find it in very, very young children, you find it also in the behavior of higher primates. So, and it was always axiomatic in anthropology. If something is a practice in a higher primate, it must be a biological rather than a culturally determined factor. But what we're actually talking about really here is the fact, this use of the word equality. What, for them, what they mean by equality is identity. It is, there's a belief that we must, ultimately, that gender is a, gender doesn't exist, ultimately. That gender is, we live this weird world where at the same time, the same people seem to believe that gender is both utterly unimportant and the most important thing in the world. But I think this goes back to the 70s and this notion which developed in radical feminism and in post-Marxian theory, which was that the ultimate way to solve man's problems, humankind's problems, was going to be in androgyny.
I think my personal favourite theory, just a wonderful example of someone holding two incompatible beliefs, is related to sexuality. And it's the belief that on one hand, sexuality is not innate or biological, but is encultured or socialized, or is a personal feeling you have.
Yeah.
And on the other, that conversion therapy cannot work and is a gross violation of your human rights.
And should be made illegal.
If sexuality is biological, conversion therapy can't work, and forcing someone to try and change something they can't change would be a gross violation of their rights. If it's a social phenomenon, that would seem eminently changeable, maybe not easily changeable. And then the question would really be, just does it work in this particular instance?
Well, this is going back and this goes back to a debate which has been raging, maybe the wrong word, but certainly it's a very live topic in, for example, what is fondly called the gay community, between what's called the essentialist position and structuralist. You got people like Richter in the essentialist position who say, born like that. And then others say, no, it's just a series of socialization and choices that people make. You know, this the great phrase used to be lifestyle choice. Now, I, honest to God, I've been a few gay dudes in my life. I have never met one who ever came close to suggesting that they had chosen a lifestyle. And I think most of the evidence suggests that we are looking at an interaction between genetics and intrauterine hormonal difference, possibly with an element of very, very early childhood trigger, but not every case. I think, anyway, whatever the case is, the fact is that the evidence for the other side is very weak indeed.
It does actually remind me of most of the activists I know in the transgender space have very much social constructivists. But most of the people I know who are actually transgender, now these are kind of older when there would have been less social acceptance, so I'm actually quite interested to see if it's the same now, are pretty strict down the line at biological determinists on this.
But you have to be, surely. That's the whole point of being, if you're transgender, because you're saying is, this is my gender, not the what you look at, but I have been born, I am a man in a female body, or I'm a woman, I'm a female in a man's body. But there is an absolute belief that they are somehow, they are misgendered, that their gender identity is fixed and set, and somehow they have been mispackaged. But they are absolutely, what they are very definitely not is fluid. This notion, which we should all be ultimately, if all of these things are a mixture of choice and socialization. We should be gender fluid. We just, whatever we feel like on any particular day.
So I think we should probably leave it at that. I think we've gone long enough
for a Wednesday. Just one of the last little points, sorry. And what is this? This is on gender equality. I would be very interested to see when they take the evidence, because this will be set up. That's the thing we should have said at the very beginning. This is a citizens' assembly, so this is a set up job. And let nobody expect anything to come out of this except precisely what the people who set it up want to come out of this. But let's put down a mark. Let's see how many people with a background in, say, evolutionary psychology, social evolution, or biology. How many of those people are going to be called to give evidence to this? And then we'll see how seriously the experts or worshipfully given their respect by the media. And it'll be interesting anyway. But for a Wednesday, so that's enough.
We will be back on Sunday. There's a couple of things we want to talk about. There's a bit of a fracas in American conservatism at the minute involving some youth groups that we want to go through. And also a great deal of information has been leaked from the Chinese government by a Communist Party official related to the Chinese concentration camps, a land of happy fun and sunshine, and apparently also a place totally without mercy designed to totally break people down. Oh. So we'll be going through some of what those letters say. It'll be a happy time for all.
That sounds cheerful.
It's what I think the people need on a Sunday of a day of rest. To be reminded, it could be worse. You could be in a Chinese concentration camp having your fingers broken.
Lovely. Until then, looking forward to it already.
All the best.
Bye-bye.